go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! It's Monday on the horn. Ordinarily, it would be Moran Monday. And ordinarily, well, sort of extraordinarily, there might be a trip report today. I am back from Central Texas, Waco, to be precise, with a couple of side trips up to West and down to Austin. You know, when I was a little kid, they told me if I didn't behave, I'd wind up going to the hot place. I didn't know they meant Texas. That's a joke. First and foremost, my enduring and sincere thanks to all my new friends at Waco Friends of Peace for inviting me down there to talk about mountaintop removal and to talk about the ACAC. It was genuinely inspiring. You know, I talk a lot about how it's one thing to be liberal where you're a bunch where there's a bunch of other liberals, but it takes a different sort of person to have the guts to be liberal where there ain't many of you, where you're pretty much surrounded. I met a lot of gutsy people in Waco. We had a nice discussion about mountaintop removal and about how we can end it with the ACAC. And well, as is the case with all of these trips, I am to some degree transformed. Finally got to meet face-to-face and person-to-person porn psychotherapist Rick Goodner. That was really special. Rick drove about 3 hours up from his place to join us for the conversation. It was billed as a lecture, but I really resist the idea that of lecturing. Filibobster is about as close as I'll get. I also got to speak on the campus of Baylor University to a political science class there, Dr. Brown's political science class, and they were absolutely attentive and interested and engaged, good questions, and, well, it gives a fellow hope. It really does. Because now people are engaged and interested and activated. And, for instance, there in Waco, they're going to start pressing their Republican member of Congress, who I am sure is most concerned for the well-being of the unborn. They're going to start pressing him to manifest that concern by signing on as a co-sponsor to the ACAC. That's going to take courage, and they've got it in abundance. It was indeed a fascinating trip, and it was also very, very instructive. I got to wander around the Mayborn Museum on the campus of Baylor University, and it was fascinating. We're talking about a museum of natural history, you know, dinosaur bones and stuff like that, and nowhere in the entire museum was there a statement that the dinosaur bones were 7,000 years old. In fact, directly to the contrary, this natural history museum, which is, of course, owned and operated by Southern Baptists at Baylor University, a part of the overarching Southern Baptist Convention, which believes that the Bible is inerrant and absolute literal truth, and that the world is slightly younger, just slightly younger, than the written recipe for bread and beer. There was all kinds of references to the things there being millions of years old and processes that took millions and millions of years. I can only hope that Dickland and his buddies back at the Southern Baptist Convention in Nashville never find out about what's going on at the Mayborn on the campus of Baylor University in Waco, or else, I mean, it's going to be hell's a poppin'. What? They're saying, well, that means they don't truly believe that the Bible is the literal and inerrant Word of God. Millions. And you know what? When you walk into the natural history section of the Mayborn Museum, one of the first things you see is this, they're called curiosity cabinets, and it's all kinds of just, it's a collection of stuff that a man named Stecker pulled together as a collector wandering around the Southwest, and was designed to be like the old curiosity museums of old, where nothing is labeled, no provenience, no provenance, no data, no nothing. But lo and behold, there was a small corner of one cabinet that had autographs in it. I noticed that there was an autograph, for instance, by Henry Ford. And then I looked over to my left, and there was a little photograph of a kindly looking white bearded old gentleman, and what appeared to be obviously quite real, written quite legibly underneath the photograph, was the signature of Charles Darwin. Mm-hmm. There really is. Charles Darwin's autograph is inside the museum, the Wellborn Museum of Natural History in Waco, Texas, on the campus of Baylor University. And again, just as quick as they get over the hissy of finding out, the boys at the Southern Baptist Convention, because they ain't no women's folks running any of that business, are going to have a purple polka-dotted blue screaming hissy and kittens with crocheted tails all at the same time. There was an absolutely moving display regarding, and yes, we will get to the horrors of the Navy Yard massacre in a little bit, I promise. Jesus, I'm worn out talking about these things. But there was a moving display regarding a nearby find of a huge number of mastodons, from thousands upon thousands of years ago. Mastodons that were drowned in a flood, and no, not that flood. And there was nothing about that flood, or, you know, Noah floating by and refusing to throw a really, really big life raft to the really, really big ancient. It wasn't there. But it was it was touching because there was a CGI animation to go with it. Did the case that had the Darwin autograph in it contain that apocryphal short story about how Darwin recanted and converted on his deathbed? Untrue, based on eyewitnesses. No, that wasn't even there. I mean, no context at all. You know, just there's the Charles Darwin autograph, and, well, there's Henry Ford. Go figure. It was next to, you know, some sort of 19th century doll, and it was underneath maybe a walrus tusk that had etchings on it of, like, Inuit seal or walrus hunting. No rhyme or reason at all. It started making more sense when you got a little further in. Those were just the curiosity cabinets. And they were well past curiosities. There was some magnificent stuff in there, and I was going, oh! Because the idea that there would be no data to support where the stuff came from what culture it was from was just to me. But no, the it was had Agnes been with me, I've already told her the story, and she did, she puddled up. Because the story of the flooding of that killed these mastodons, well, two of the mastodons were found to be cradling a baby mastodon in their tusks. One may presume it was the mama mastodon, a female, and the daddy mastodon, a male. And they both had the baby mastodon cradled in their tusks, presumably, according to the paleontologists who excavated, trying to raise the baby up above the rising waters and save it from drowning. That's touching. And, of course, in the CGI animation of the whole thing, there was a lot of trumpeting and bellowing and that kind of stuff. I could have stayed in there for days. I'm a real museum sucker. I will read everything. I think I got that from my sister. She used to annoy my parents by wanting to stop and read historic markers. And then when they relented, when my parents would relent and we would stop or turn around and go back to read the marker, they would both end up confessing that, yes, that was fascinating, and they were glad they did. So there was the Mayborn Museum. In the Mayborn, I met a Texan who was in there. There was an early Texas Lifeways exhibit that included a 30-foot-tall grass house built in the way that the Waco peoples who lived in the area built their houses from prairie grasses eons ago. And there was a Comanche buffalo hide teepee. And then there was a log house. And looking at both the teepee and the grass house, I thought, you know what? Those are both far more suited to the environments in which they were built than the white folks' log house. But yeah, who am I? I wandered. I was getting a little hungry by then, so I wandered on out carrying on the conversation with the native Texan fella, who had been sent there to answer an exam question: what will Texans be like in 300 years? And of course, one of the first things I noted was, well, they'll be a lot more uniform in color. But he was being the typically optimistic. They're an optimistic lot, Texans. They operate under, apparently, as far as I could tell, they operate under the principle that as long as they're left alone, they'll be fine. As long as the federal government will just keep sending them checks to build roads with, but not ask them to do anything in return, they'll be great. Road construction up and down I-35. I was amazed. I don't think I can find that much road construction in the entire state of West Virginia. But he was optimistic, and you know, hell, we're Texans. We'll be fine. We'll get through all this. And then, you know, because I am the serpent in the garden, I started talking about the 30 towns in the western part of the state that have just had all of their wells sucked dry by the fracking industry. And talked a little bit about the fact that Galveston, Corpus Christi, and Houston in the next maybe 100 years will be under freaking water. And how then, you know, Waco will be beachfront property. No, I'm kidding. But Austin damned well may be. But we talked, and then he showed me across the campus of Baylor because I was getting a little hungry. And I wound up wandering into this little place called Food for Thought, where I, food porn section of the program, had one of the most amazing little snacks I've ever had in my life. Any of y'all ever had a baked avocado? Because I hadn't, and now I have, and I can vouch for the fact that they are damn delicious. You take a nice, fresh, ripe avocado, you cut it in half, you pull the pit out, and the hollow there in the center, you don't peel it or anything. Um, and you fill the hollow with like chopped tomatoes and sliced black olives and a little bit of onion, and you cover the lot of it, and then a dollop of sour cream, and you cover the lot with some cheese, and you run it under the broiler until the cheese gets all bubbly and brown and melty, and you pull it out and you serve it, and you just kind of eat it with salsa and chips and scoop it out. It was delicious, and I immediately started thinking, and I tweeted about it, of course, thinking, a little vinegar, a little lemon juice, a little lime juice, yeah. And then I got to thinking, man, if you did that, wow, you could use like avocado and artichoke hearts and spinach and mozzarella. And then I got to think, ooh, lump crab meat, ooh, Parmesan cheese, ooh, panko breadcrumbs. Bring it on. So we'll be trying that soon. Then on Saturday, because that was Friday. Marty, you're a heathen, okay? I'd rather go to Scotland and get a deep, nice deep-fried Mars bar. I was never a Mars bar guy to begin with. They kind of made me nauseated. But I would like to go to Scotland sometime. The old sod. Then Saturday was a day trip. And the first thing we did is we rolled up to West, that little Czech village there, hard by the verges of I-35, because I wanted to see what happens when ammonium nitrate explosions, like what happen every day in Appalachia, happen. And this isn't voyeuristic. I actually had a point. And it was horrifying. Now, the ammonium nitrate explosion at the unregulated, uninspected fertilizer plant in West Texas occurred in April of this year. By my reckoning, that's about 5 months ago. And when we got down there to the site of the fertilizer plant, which is absolutely just flat, empty, nothing there. The debris has all been cleared away, but I think the blast did a lot of that work. You could still smell the ammonium nitrate. Because, I mean, you know what garden fertilizer smells like? Well, that's what it was. And then we began to drive around a little bit. And I snapped a few pictures. Not out of some gory sense of disaster tourism, but again, because I felt a sense of connection with the people there. It was, of course, an accident when the fertilizer plant in West Texas blew up. But accident or intentional, the explosive results are the same. And my God, We saw nearby places that had once been houses that were just empty spaces. We saw one brick home, probably, three-bedroom ranch style, that's the way they're described in the real estate listings, that all its windows were gone and the roof was completely gone and the place was empty. And little stars, a little five-pointed stars on sticks that said, West Strong. And there was a big empty space back behind where the fertilizer plant had been that I later realized had been where the local middle school was and the little middle school football field and the track. And about a quarter of a mile away is the West High School, which was this big, beautiful, brick, new-looking high school. And, school's in, and it was empty. There had been a nursing home, and the nursing home was just gone. And there was a neighborhood back behind of nice, nice houses, a neighborhood back behind the fertilizer plant, and there were just every so often there would be an empty lot and maybe some dumpsters for clearing away the debris. The explosive force of ammonium nitrate is profound indeed. I mean, that's why the guy who invented it for the Germans, for the Kaiser. because it was the principal component of their explosives throughout the First World War. But as we drove around, and there were heartbreaking things across with, you know, "We shall never forget," things like that written on it, a memorial right across the road where a house was, from right across the, you know, just a little barely two-lane road. It's just a road through a neighborhood. By the way, the road that ran in front of the middle school back behind the fertilizer plant that had not been inspected in God knows how long and was operating under the miracle of free market deregulation, the middle school sat on Reagan Drive. "Sometimes I wish the goddess of irony would just leave me the F alone." Reagan Drive, really. But as we drove around, and my guide and host in all of this was Dr. Allen, whom you've heard me mention, just a magnificent human being and one of the best hosts you could ever hope to have. All my needs were met and were done so with true geniality, and it, within a matter of an hour of meeting him at the airport in Waco on last Wednesday, I felt like I had known him for eons. It's neat when friends meet like that. Well, the same thing attached to Rick Goodner, because I have known him for eons, or at least years. Probably 10 years since. But no, I was immediately at ease with Dr. Allen. And so he didn't balk at all at the idea of us running around up to West and so forth. And we took several passes back and forth in front of the in front of where the fertilizer plant had been. We saw this one stark place where the mailbox was left in the ground, and there was still a little sidewalk, and it walked back to where there were a couple of metal garden chairs, but no house. And there was something deeply sad about that. But all along, and I took some photos, and it took a while for it to dawn upon me. All these places that had been affected by the blast, even something that looked like it wasn't that affected, namely the high school, the brand new looking high school, had been circumvallated with a brand new chain link fence. As had, for instance, the site of the fertilizer plant itself. And there was something about those chain link fences that began just sort of, it was like an itch you can't scratch. What was it? Why? Why were the chain link fences there? I mean, the fertilizer plant was gone. There was nothing in there worth stealing. I mean, there were some tanks and stuff for removing debris and toxins, and then they went, toxins, oh my God. Even the high school that looked like it was pretty much okay, but had some windows blown out, had a chain link fence around it. And there were signs on the roads into neighborhoods, the roads were blocked off, you couldn't go into them. Five months after the blast, long after any possible looting could have or would have taken place, they were fenced off. And after the little light bulb went on over my head, it didn't take me long to get from "they're fenced off" to "why are they fenced off?" And then I realized, because it is acknowledged that these sites that have been affected by the blasting dust from ammonium nitrate explosives are toxic, are potentially lethal to human beings. And then I thought about home. And I thought about places like Cayford Mountain and Cherry Pond Mountain and Coal River Mountain and all the other 497 plus mountains that have been blown to smithereens, and there ain't a chain link fence to be found around a one of them, nor around any of the places where the damnable toxic dust has fallen. See what I'm getting at? In a horrible industrial accident, there is acknowledgement, even in deregulated, frenzied Texas, that the outfall of such explosives is dangerous, downright potentially lethal to human life. But here in central Appalachia, there are no chain link fences. There is nothing to protect anyone against breathing the dust immediately following one of these godforsaken blasts, nor to protect anyone from the dust that will fly. And can you imagine how far a 2.5 micron sized particle of poison can go on just a puff of wind? Most likely a right long way. But there is nothing here to protect us. Nothing to indicate that anything is other than just dandy. Yeah. And that was the lesson of West Texas. Magnificent little community that it is. And it is wonderful. It is magnificent. It is a little Czech enclave. And you may remember some months back when Edward called from Dallas to say, if you ever get a chance to go through there, you must try the kolaches. I did. I absolutely did. Beautiful little fluffy pastries filled with a delicious fruit filling, apple, peach, apricot, cherry, strawberry, coconut, pineapple, prune. Yum. Just yum, especially when they're warm and fresh out of the oven. And there's several bakeries there in West, and they all specialize in kolaches and these wonderful breads. They had a huge case, well, not huge, but a big case full of nothing but freshly made summer sausages and beef sticks and smoked jalapeno cheddar sausages, and wow! And I brought home a jar of West Texas style chili pepper hot sauce. Kind of thick. Really good. And we stopped there because I stopped there specifically on account of Edward and Dallas, and because of a suggestion from Beth, also in Dallas, that if we found ourselves there to try to kick a little bit into the local economy, and we did exactly that. Dr. Allen was also under orders to bring back some kolaches, so he did as well. And West Texas is a tiny community, not very big at all, with vast expanses of what appears to be farmland surrounding it. Not much bigger, not any bigger, in fact, than some of these Appalachian communities that have the same kind of toxins blasted onto them every day as happened on a nightmare evening in April 2013 in West. And there are a lot of signs in West that say, you know, we're going to be strong, we're going to get through this, we're going to get over this. A manifestation of a community spirit that recognizes it's still a community. But there aren't any stay strong signs in places like Twilight or Cayford. No. There's finally a memorial to the 29 miners who were incinerated alive at the Upper Big Branch mine in Whitesville. But there is no marker there to note how people are supposed to stay strong after having had the equivalent of 4,400 cruise missiles detonated on them day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. There are no stay strong signs at the funeral parlors where the victims of cancer seem to die day after day, week after week. Well, they don't die there, they just get taken there. Day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. So our little side trip, and I think west is about 22 miles north of Waco on I-35. Our little side trip to Waco turned out to be a profound experience. I mentioned it briefly in my remarks to the Waco Friends of Peace, but it was before I had gone there. Had I been talking to them after I had gone there, I think my remarks would have been even more influenced by that trip. Having seen west, we then turned around and headed back south. Oh, back up. On Thursday, and I really was host. They're not kidding when they, you know, there's Southern hospitality and there's Texas hospitality. And everything you've ever heard about Texas hospitality is true. It is magnificent. On Thursday night, after speaking to the class at Baylor and after speaking to Waco Friends of Peace, I was because it's pretty well known that I am a barbecue fiend. We went down about 30 miles south of Waco. Because Dr. Allen's significant other had gone researching, to find out a really awesome barbecue joint to take me to. And she found one. And they took me to a place called Miller's Smokehouse in Belton. And if you ever get within, if you're within 10 miles of that place and you love barbecue, you must go. You simply must go. And this isn't one of those places that's been open for 100 years and, you know, somebody's great-granddad. This is a little startup. This is the product of a new dream. It's only been open for 5 years or so, 9 years total in what they're doing. And it came from the fact that the father of the family loved to do, you know, had his smoker going most any weekend, brisket on there, maybe some, they make their own sausages. Whew! Make their own sides. Mama Miller makes the desserts. I had a slice of warm, fresh out of the oven coconut pie that was just sinful. And so I had the brisket and ribs plate with green beans and potato casserole and a nice tall pint of Shiner Oktoberfest draft to accompany it. A fellow was standing in the corner singing classic country music, playing and singing. Wasn't karaoke night or nothing. And, wow. Just wow. And it was only at the end when I was talking to the son of the owner, member of the family, and I said, "Yeah, I just ran out of room, couldn't try the sausage." He said, "You wait here." and brings back some of the hickory smoked cheddar jalapeno sausage and oh my goodness. Belton, Texas. Miller's Smokehouse did their own sauce. It was all just wonderful. I ordered the brisket. They said, "Now, do you want the lean or do you want it with a little bit of fat?" Now, see, I'm trying to be good. I'm trying to learn. I said, "Bring me the lean." And it was so tender, you just touched it with the fork, the sliced brisket, and it fell apart. Oh, come on, Marty. I would not drink Sam Adams beer in Texas any more than I would drink Lone Star in Massachusetts. Come now, sir. Please. What, no Sam Adams Oktoberfest? Oh, gracious. It's like, I don't know. That's like eating your tapioca pudding with the shrimp fork, for God's sakes. And then finally, back to Saturday. And by the way, Belton, Texas is the county seat of Bell County, Texas. And I had one of those little flash light bulb moments. Where have I heard of Bell County? Well, it turns out Bell County was a place I'd heard about in years past. It's the place where one of the last great Grand Ole Opry comedians was born. The father of a dear friend of ours. Holland, Texas, in Bell County. And so on Saturday, as we blew and I saw the Bell County line sign, I went, wow, this is just getting... Yeah. And we cruised on through, you know, past Temple, past Bell, past Georgetown, and to say that any one of these is a clearly delineated place is not true, because it's just one long sprawl from Waco to Austin. Very few blank spots along the way. And got to Austin, a place that I've long been fascinated with, and went walkabout on the campus, and it was a fortunate thing in so far as it was a Saturday game day for the Texas Longhorns, the Rebels of Ole Miss had come to call. SEC versus Big 12, interconference rivalry battle, that kind of thing. And you know what? Everything is bigger in Texas. The tailgating was huge. Just huge. And the air was redolent with the smell of mesquite smoke. Apparently everybody brings their own smoker to the tailgates in Austin. And people were friendly and effusive and you know, hook 'em horns. And the people and they were very nice to the Ole Miss fans who had come to see the game. And the Ole Miss fans returned the favor by beating the stuffing out of Texas. I mean, beat them bad. Beat them like they owed them money. Beat them like borrowed mules, 44-23. It was the crown sits not soundly on the head of Coach Mack Brown at this point in time. And for those of you who did not believe it possible, Dr. Allen treated me to dinner afterwards, after we'd walked around the campus, and the campus of the University of Texas is just breathtakingly beautiful. Just gorgeous. University of Texas is about, I think, 8 years younger than my alma mater, West Virginia University, but the difference could not be more stark. Gorgeous architecture, that big old tower, trees everywhere. I can see why anybody going there would be mighty proud to say that they were an alumnus or an alumna of the organization. Or the institution, I should say. But after we had gone walkabout in Austin and I had seen the campus, Dr. Allen took me to dinner at his favorite vegetarian spot in Austin, a place called Mother's Cafe. And I can hear, really, this is like Romper Room. I can hear you all now. Bob went to a vegetarian. Yes, Bob did. And Bob had a delicious meal. It was wonderful. I had a chili relleno with black beans and organic brown rice. A fella couldn't have asked for any better. It was absolutely delicious. And then we made our way home, and I packed stuff up and got out yesterday and flew on back here to the hills and hollers of almost level West by God, Virginia. Didn't have nearly as harrowing a flight back as I did. My God, there was a weather system that extended all the way from Charleston, West Virginia to Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. And apparently, it was like one of those little tracking dots. Wherever I was, the bad weather was, too. We were, for all intents and purposes, the two-hour flight on American Airlines from Charleston, West Virginia to Dallas-Fort Worth was just a matter of that little traveling dot being being followed by foul winds and vicious cross currents and hellacious turbulence. I mean, those puffy white clouds, they look so innocuous, but you get into them and they slap you around something fierce. It was a long 2 hours from Charleston to Dallas. Flight from Dallas to Waco is, you're barely wheels up before your wheels back down. That was a brutal ride, but much better coming back. And all in all, I have to say that the staff aboard American Airlines flights are much friendlier than the staff on Delta, and I fly Delta most of the time. Either way, they both fly those little Bombardier Canadair regional jet affairs, the ones that were built by Keebler Elves for Keebler Elves. Those planes. Still, all told, okay. I had two seats to myself on the way to Dallas Fort Worth, and that was great because I could straddle it and sort of hang on for dear life to both armrests. I'm not a bad flyer. I'm not afraid to fly. I just don't like it when you fall, 500 feet, boom, done, and it sounds like there's somebody banging with a hammer on the outside of the aircraft, and you can feel the rivets vibrating under the seats. It's not fun. But it is extremely gratifying to know that the Waco Friends of Peace are going to organize around the AIC Act and make noise about it in a place where it's never had noise made about it before. And I even received emails from members of the class at Baylor University saying that they too are going to get behind the AIC Act. That's one of the fascinating things. When ordinary, everyday Americans hear about what's happening in Appalachia, they gladly put their shoulder into the effort. And there's a big difference between that and some congressional staffer who sits and plays with her hair and clicks her pen, repeatedly. As if sending out some sort of get these hillbillies out of here mayday distress call in Morse code. There's a big difference. So I suspect the man who represents that district in Texas is going, well, what in the world are these people contacting me about things going on in Appalachia for? Mercy sakes. I like the idea of that. Oh, and thank you. Thank you going out to Sal, who was first in with a $10 contribution to get us going. Thanks to Brian over the weekend. We also heard from Thomas. Thank you very kindly for getting us going, because as I predicted when I left here last week, you know, we had shows Monday and Tuesday, nothing on Wednesday. Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, we had about a $600 hole, and it remained pretty much a $600 hole. So now this evening, to be fair, a couple of some help did come in. But at this point in time, fundraising to keep us going and keep us afloat is rather dire. It is the 16th day of September 2013, and the hole we're in is about $700 deep. That would be 70 folks at 10 bucks a piece, 35 at 20, et cetera, et cetera. So anybody who can help along the way, you know, $5, $10, it makes a big difference. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com, and the help is deeply appreciated. Dr. John, commenting on my remark about the teepee versus the grass house versus the log home, log house at the Mayborn Museum. Teepees versus log houses. Of course, your house type depends on how you subsist. For mobile hunters and foragers, you can't build a permanent structure because when it's time to move, you can't bring it with you. Permanent houses require a concept of private property. These are my crops, my fields, my logs, my animals, my wildlife. An alien idea to people who see the world as full of bounty to share and not to own. Very true, indeed. And, of course, the other thing that struck me is it's a lot easier to replace. And the grass house was just beautiful. Pretty much as much usable space as the log house had. And the log house was actually a real log house from the mid-1800s that had been transported to the Mayborn Museum. But it struck me that in that flat part of the country where killer winds are prone to cranking up some pretty nasty storms, replacing that grass house would be significantly less labor intensive, and you would be back under shelter much more quickly than if you had to go and fell a bunch of trees. But Dr. John's basic point is absolutely correct. You have to conceptualize ownership of things that, you know, within really can't be owned. No, Marty, look up the Bombardier Canadair Regional Jet CRJ-200. That's what I was on from Charleston to Dallas. So that's pretty much the trip report. And I guess I get to stay put for a little bit here. Might be doing D.C., some D.C. work in October, but that's at least a couple of weeks away. Right now, the immediate need is to make sure that the Horn will continue broadcasting through this week. And that means that we've got to crawl out of this hole in a really big, big way. I mean, not big. Good God. Like I said, 70 folks at 10 bucks a piece. Or 7 at 100, you know, whichever works best. But that's what'll keep us going, because we keep paying bills and the bills keep coming in. And that's just how it works, I guess. PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com. I have not given, as I usually do, I have not given the traditional mail address. I probably should. The Horn, excuse me. The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318. Beckley, WV 25801. Remember, checks, money orders should not be made payable to Bob Kincaid, but to Head On Communications or The Horn, Head On. Boss Man Lane tells me head-on communications is about the best way to go about it. And that way we can make a lot closer to certain that we will have, let's see, Titanic Tuesday, prayer meeting Wednesday, thorn in the side Thursday, and Friday on the front porch. 10 minutes before the hour, and yeah, I was all excited when I got home yesterday because, like I said, I love doing the trip reports, and more things will occur to me to mention the thing because I'm just, when I go on these journeys to places that I've never seen before, I'm just soaking it all in. I stood there and looked at the topographic map of Texas, and particularly Central Texas, in the museum, and got a much better handle on the lay of the land, and got a in King of the Hill. Hank Hill's favorite beer. What's the name of it? I can't remember the name of the beer, but I remember the what's the slogan for the beer? From the lukewarm headwaters of the Brazos River. I understand now. And it's even funnier. I also learned that it's not, as I have, you know, because I've looked at it all these years, and Brazos, well, that's obviously Spanish, and I'm thinking that's the Brazos River. Turns out it's the Brazos de la Deo, the Arms of God River. But no, by God, it's the Brazos. It's the Brazos River. And now, whenever I see that word, I will forever hear it in, is it Alamo beer, Jack? Jack in Shreveport, Alamo beer from the headwaters of the, from the lukewarm headwaters of the Brazos River. What? And the Brazos is the 11th longest river in the United States? No idea. Had no idea. But the region is beautiful. People like me who have never been to a place like Texas, we tend to imagine Texas as just this great, arid, dry, barren place. And I know that's going to piss somebody off. But it just does. There's a lot of greenery there. I mean, but it was dry. It was kind of amazing to me to see all these big, white, fluffy, puffy clouds that were absolutely no good for making rain whatsoever. But remember, climate change is a big old host and hoax, and as Dr. Paul Brown of Georgia would put it, just full of those sciencey lies from the pits of hell. But it's, you know, we've had our fun with Texas over the years. I don't think Texas jokes or stories out of Texas are ever going to mean quite the same to me as they did before I was there. And I can't say for certain why. But, it's weird. There's an optimism there. Now, this is a state that has been more toxically polluted between Dim Leader in the 90s and Rick Goodhair Perry in the aughts than probably any state short of, you know, West Virginia. Maybe when you work in the refineries and the fracking and all that, maybe even more so. And it's a state that has millions of uninsured people and people working every day busting their ass to get by. And yet, because it's Texas, they feel like, well, as my one conversation showed, they thought, well, you know what? It'll be okay, though. We'll get this fixed. And bless their hearts, even the progressives there, you know, like I said, it's one thing to be progressive where there's a bunch of them. It's another thing to be optimistically progressive in a place where you know that there aren't many like you. And yet to retain an optimism that, yes, even in small numbers, you can affect real and meaningful cultural and social change. That's profound. And as I said in conversation, I understand now better than I did. America, as a country, and despite people, you know, even that guy who wrote that book called Better Off Without Him, who was positing this sort of secession by agreement thing where the United States would split up and places like Alabama stand and Georgia stand and Tennessee stand and would all go and form their own separate nation. Even in his theory, Texas remained a part of the Union. Because America needs Texas. I think you could say that in many ways Texas forms the mythic center of our country. Those notions of rugged idealism and of carving out an existence, for good or ill, it is part of our mythos. And a hell of a lot of it comes straight out of Texas. You know, I was speaking at Baylor University, so I decided to do a little homework before I left. And I found out that going down to that Baptist University, and it's a big, big, big old university, too, and plenty expensive. And I found out that they're in the process of building a $227 million brand-new football stadium there on the banks of the Brazos River, because it says right there... It says right there on the in the book of Matthew, for if you have not built a $227 million football stadium for the least of these my brothers, you have not also built a $227 million football stadium for me. They're going to save souls with that stadium. They are. They really are. But I got to studying about where Baylor University came from. What, Kevin? Kevin in Colorado Springs. I know, I'm being a really bad, bad current events host just talking about the trip and everything instead of talking about the butchery in Washington, D.C. today. Kevin telling me, are you watching any of the feeds? They're saying possible firecrackers, shots at the White House. Idiot that did that on this day gets my nomination for Moran Monday. Yeah, without a doubt. At any rate, yes, and the Colorado flooding. I know. When I'm gone, I kind of focus on the stuff that I'm working on, and I saw the Colorado flooding tangentially, and my heart just broke. 1,000-year floods. Well, at least we've got those over with until the next 1,000-year floods. That's the problem. 1,000-year floods aren't 1,000-year floods anymore. And yes, there may be, as Texas Betsy notes, a relationship to fracking. And I would not be 10 cents worth of surprised. But at the risk of seeming entirely self-centered, let me just finish this off real quick. I like to do a little research about where I'm going, so I looked up how Baylor University came into existence. And lo and behold, there I was in the year 2013, a hillbilly, going to Texas, and following in the footsteps of another hillbilly. because Robert Edward Bledsoe Baylor was a hillbilly who came out of the low foothills of Appalachia, having been born in like 1793, 1794, not too awfully far from where our buddy Dennis lives. Dennis, with whom I mow grass, you know, he puts you and me and all the conversation in his MP3 player, and we mow grass together. You, me, all of us. Dennis, hey Dennis, not too far from where Dennis lives. We Robert E. R.E.B. Baylor took up, and first he lit out to the brand new state of Alabamistan, where he got himself elected to Congress, couldn't get reelected, and then participated in a war against the last remaining bands of Muskogee people who didn't want to be, who had already been forced westward from Georgia and didn't cotton much to being forced out of Alabama either. But when he ran out of Indians to fight, he got himself anointed or ordained or whatever as a Baptist minister. And the new Republic of Texas had been formed. And see, that was kind of fascinating because look, teabaggerism is not new. A whole lot of the people who went and settled up to try to carve a nation out from under Mexico and call it Texas, if they were not already there as part of the native population, went there because they were already tired of the overreaching federal government. The seeds of all of this stuff got laid in 1774, 1775, when colonists began pushing further westward across the Alleghenies than George III said they really ought to be going. And the British actually tried to arm and help the native peoples resist the westward expansion, but by God, they were going west. By 1804, 1803, Aaron Burr was cooking up a scheme to go over and start his own little empire out from under the Spanish colonial government of Mexico. And so, with Alabama having become a state and fallen under the sway of the overreaching federal government, remember this is roughly the same time that John C. Calhoun over in South Carolina is cooking up the notion of nullification. Well, with his ordination or anointing or whatever fresh on him, R.E.B. Baylor takes out and winds up stopping in Waco, where in the young Texas Republic they decide that there needs to be a first-class institution for the raising up of young scholars and holy men. And R.E.B. Baylor became a judge. And it was said of R.E.B. Baylor that he traveled with the laws of the Republic of Texas in one saddlebag and the Bible in the other. Look, it was going to be a theocracy. Oh, wait. So, you know, just following in the footsteps of more hillbillies. Maybe trying to make up for past transgressions. Fascinating, huh? So here endeth the filibobster, I suppose. The trip report. And soon and very soon, we will uh, go marching off into the blood-sodden swamps of another another bloody day in America. But it is also Moran Monday. And never doubt for a moment that we got Morans aplenty. Aplenty. So fire up the phone lines if you wish. You know the number, 304-658-3333. And on the Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. That works equally well. And we'll get the conversation going. Sorry, I'm just looking for an appropriate bumper. Not liking really anything I find. Well, okay, we'll default to that. By the way, thanks going out, many and deep thanks going out to Jay. Jay just dropping a note. Mythic is the operative word concerning Texas. It's mostly myth, or more accurately, BS. I can say that because I lived there for almost 15 years. Yeah. There's always a lot of BS in myth. But somehow or another, it's what people attach to it. Hell, I took my boots with me to Texas. There was no way I was going to go to, you know, I love boots. And for some reason or another, Tony Lamas fit me like tennis shoes fit other people. They just do. I took them with me to Texas. There was no way I was going to go to Texas for perhaps the one and only time in my life and not wear damn cowboy boots down there. I was participating in the myth. Whether it's BS or not. So, yeah, Jay's got it. Myth, of course, is what we make of it. Just like a theocratic Baptist minister, lawyer, judge who wants to make sure that the young'uns of the young Republic of Texas get a proper grounding in Latin and Greek, winds up founding a university that 160 years later, instead of offering Latin and Greek, has chalk advertisements on the concrete saying, come to the Latin dance club, join the Latin dance club, and then Greek ice cream social. And it has nothing to do with Homer or Ovid or Virgil or Sapphic. No, it's fraternities and sororities on the one hand, and merengue and salsa, and yeah, Dan, sure. Myth is what you make of it. But thanks, Jay, for kicking in and helping out this evening. Thanks very much. Again, thanks to Sal, Thomas. It all helps keep all of this going. And, Betsy has put the payday challenge up for this evening. Betsy has kicked in $75 and says, if you got paid this month, pay for the horn. Seriously, pay up and stop the begging and the worrying. I think the begging and the worrying is what I'm doing. Yeah, because it is worrisome. Now, I don't want the lights to go out here. That's the truth. And shortly after that came in, Rob kicked in with his contribution, and that means we've got 65 more to meet what Betsy challenged. And with any luck at all, we can take a big hunk out of the hole that we're in. It's partially my fault, because when I go on the road, we get in a hole. But by the same token, I hope you all understand that when I get an opportunity to go and tell people about what they can do to help end an absolute human rights disaster here in Appalachia, it's hard to pass up that opportunity. I know the two things are in conflict, and I thank you profoundly for both your forbearance, your patience, and your understanding. So, light them up, the phones, that is, or anything else you want to light up for that matter. This is Conversation Radio. I'm Bob Kincaid, and this is The Horn. I was kind of humming this while I was down there.
There's a cowboy in the jungle, and he looks so out of place. With his shrimp skin boots and his cheap cheroots, and his skin as white as paste. Heading south to Paraguay, where the gauchos sing and shout. Now he's stuck in Portobello, since his money all ran out. So he hangs out with the sailors, night and day they're raising hell. And his original destination's just another story that he loves to tell. With no plans for the future, he still seems in control. From a Bronco ride to a 10-foot tie, he just had to learn to roll. Roll with the punches, laid all of his hunches, made the best of whatever came his way. What he lacked in ambition, he made up with intuition. Their music floats across the bay, while American women and moo-moos talk about all the things they did today. And their husbands quack about fishing, as this slug goes rum drinks down, discussing who caught what and who sat on his butt. But it's the only show in town. They're trying to
satellites, they remind me of where we are. Spinning around in circles, living it day to day, and still 24 hours, maybe 60 good years. It's really not that long a stay. We gotta roll with the punches.
Yeah, it was especially that line about, and his skin is white as paste. That one. This is the Horn. It's Moran Monday, and lines lighting up on the phones, 304-658-3333. If you want to jump in line to comment or carry on or cuss and discuss, let's go to it forthwith. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, speaking of mythic.
Hey, Kevin.
Floods were here in Colorado.
Yeah, I've seen the word biblical used more than once or twice.
Yeah, and it's kind of like you said, you know, the thousand-year floods are becoming the one-year floods. We've dealt with this for last summer and this summer since the fire. The thing that was different for me is you expected the burn scar area flooding. It was flooding in places here in the city I've never seen flood before. Just absolutely have never seen or heard. I've been here 16 years, and I've just never heard or seen of it. And then up in Boulder, I can't see the pictures, but I've heard. And that's just unreal. You know, these poor people up there, some of them haven't even been rescued yet.
No, the numbers of missing are terrifying.
Yeah, and I told my family last night, I said, it's like 500 people missing. Even if 75% of those people are with relatives or whatever, that's still 25% that something has happened to. And that's...
Well, I mean, multiply 500 and some by the number of people that must surely be worried out of their minds.
Exactly.
I mean, that's a lot of grief. That's a lot of fear. That's a lot of terror. That's a lot of anguish.
Yeah, sure. And there's no way. I mean, if that kind of flooding, you don't have cell towers, you don't have electric, phone, anything, you could be perfectly okay, but you can't reach anybody, you know. And it just... I will say this. I grew up in Tampa, and we started to see flooding down in Tampa just with thunderstorms. And what a lot of this is places that were normally open space have been covered by concrete. And the more you cover things with concrete, the less drainage you have. And that's a large part of what I think's happening here. And the
These aren't... In a place like Colorado, Kevin, help me out here. Are things like floodplains easily definable?
They used to be.
Until they got covered with concrete. Okay, yeah.
Right. Well, that and the fact that when I say they used to be, I'm talking about the creeks and rivers and that. Yeah, that was easily definable. But we had two big sinkholes here in Colorado Springs that opened up in the last day. And we've got mines here that were built over 100 years ago. Houses are sitting above these mines, and they don't exactly know where a lot of these places are. So with all this flooding, not surprising. But, yeah, when you say floodplains are definable, they used to be because we're getting flooding in places we've never had it before. And whether it's because of the concrete or the global warming or the burn scar or whatever, the one thing's clear is it's changing. And it's going to be a concern for us for the rest of the year, because every time it rains, we go through this now. And unless we get a spell of like 21 days without rain, we're going to have to worry about this. Even during the winter, when the snow melts, our snow usually doesn't stay on the ground that long. So, you know, if we get a 4-inch snow, then we're going to have to worry about that. And I'm lucky I'm up on the second floor, so I don't have any real worries. But, you know, I just think of the people, especially up in the Boulder area, who, like the people in Texas at the ammonium nitrate plant, they don't have anything left.
No, you know? Scrubbed, scoured.
Yeah, exactly. And... so,
and I don't mean, Kevin, I hope you'll understand, I'm not trying to be insensitive here. I'm trying to draw very bright lines. It seems like with what has gone on in Appalachia for the last 15 to 20 years, especially, that we've been sort of a, and I hate to even use the phrase, canary in the coal mine for what the rest of the country could expect.
Yeah.
We've got the poisoning from ammonium nitrate, from extensive ammonium nitrate blasting. We've got massive deforestation. We have tremendous floods and weather events that no one, even the old folks here, remember ever even happening. And now, as we go absolutely crazy for the last shreds of hydrocarbon energy wherever we can lay our hands on them. Those things to which Appalachia was subjected are spreading out to other parts of the country.
Yep.
And it is because of this. I don't know what else to call it, Kevin, except to call it energy extremism. Because there's nothing particularly extreme in wanting to put up a solar panel or a wind turbine, but if you want to drill down 5,000 feet, drain aquifers, cause earthquakes, perhaps contribute to massive flooding, just so that some CEO for an energy company can get richer because he hasn't figured out yet that they don't put hearses behind put U-Hauls behind hearses, that's extreme.
Yep.
So, yeah. I get what you're about and what you're saying, and one begins to wonder in a country where a big chunk of a body politic is convinced that government is just not a good idea anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I begin to wonder how we're going to continue to cut. Because do you have any sense, Kevin, that this is going to become less and not more? Because I've got the sense that this is going to, we're going to see more and more and more and more of this.
Well, it's been predicted with the global warming. You're going to see more and more of it, and there's nothing in that prediction that we haven't already seen come true. You know, you didn't know what the word derecho meant last year until you experienced it. So, you know, we didn't know what floods were like to this magnitude. We had one in 76 that was kind of like this, but I guarantee you when this one's all said and done, it'll eclipse the 76 flood, because there's just a lot of the damage isn't even known yet because of the number of missing and you know, the inaccessible areas. Some of the stuff is up in the mountains, you know, I mean, it's just...
Well, see, it's kind of, I mean, just to transfer it, oh, it's kind of like, lo and behold, I was watching my feed. I got up this morning, you know, turned the TV on, drink the coffee, and then, you know, breaking news, gunshots fired at the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C. Well, hell, the baseball stadium's not far from the Navy Yard. I've been there with my son. We've seen the buildings. I've been across the river. Well, I remember when Pterodactyl and I went to spring Mike Malloy from jail. After the protest a couple of years ago, we were sitting over there at the National Park Service incarceration facility, and I was looking directly across the Anacostia River at the Navy Yard, where there's this one destroyer that's a museum ship now, I guess, a World War II era destroyer.
Yep.
And it's weird when you can see something like that, and then something like this happens this morning, and you reflect back and go, "Damn, you know, I know it's not just. I mean, it's not that you feel somehow like you're part of it, but you know, you've got to. You can at least visualize and know that I don't know that there's that you're in, that you're part of a greater whole. I mean, there's a big difference between that, Kevin, and what I because I was watching Chicken Noodle News because. To use a term that Kate mentions in an email I just got, we're violence junkies now. We're disaster junkies. We turn to the TV, and so there was Wolf Blitzer, for-profit media millionaire journalist, who was describing the Navy Yard event today as, and these events are taking place not very far from where I am. And my first thought was, well, you better get under the desk, Wolf.
Yeah.
You know, as if, you know, he was the story. And that's not what I'm trying to convey here at all. But the idea that there is an interconnectedness, but lo and behold, I'm watching my feed and all of a sudden here it comes. And you know what it was, don't you, Kevin? Pray for the people. Pray for the people. Pray for the people. And I'm getting very close to that point in time when I'm going to use the full word and say F praying. Get out there and do something about gun violence in the United States.
Yep.
I mean, I have no. Is it tolerance that I'm worn out on, or is it? I don't know. But I have no patience for people who want to just sit there and say, "Well, it's America, and we got our guns, and we got our freedom, and pray for them." And I would, you know, the irony was not lost on me that. The dude was from Fort Worth, Texas.
Yep. And the
not that that's a direct correlation, but you know, damn.
Oh well, it probably will be because the little background I've heard on him so far, he was involved in two shooting incidents for which he didn't get prosecuted in Seattle and Texas, where he shot out some tires and then shot out a hole in his apartment. Ceiling. So I'd almost predict you'll find out he's one of these non-government nuts. But either way.
But oh, I gotta share something with you. This was I tweeted this earlier. I don't know if you saw this or not. The one thing that just stopped me in my tracks. They're interviewing two of the people who survived and got out unscathed, and there's a black guy standing next to a white woman. CNN, of course. Because I think we're very close to developing a law of nature here on the order of something like Godwin's law, but this is a law of nature that will a natural law, a scientific law that will be applicable to the for-profit media. In any live and ongoing disaster, the likelihood of something stupid being said approaches one to one the nearer Wolf Blitzer gets to the situation.
Yep.
So this woman and this man were being interviewed. She's white, he's black, and they're asking her, you know, for her impression of what happened. And they asked her to describe the gunman. She said, well, he's about 6 feet tall, and he was bald and black. At which point she takes like a two count. You know what a comedy two count is, you know, boom, boom, laugh line. She takes like a two count and does a take and looks at the bald black guy standing next to her. And just that little moment, I went, really? What's the... Oh, my... Because it was clearly, you know, it wasn't something she was conscious about. She was just, you know, well, he was bald and he was black. Beat and look.
Yep.
And oddly enough, that hasn't shown back up in the, because they've shown the interview with the woman and the guy a number of times on CNN, but that part has not been shown again.
Oh, too bad. Yeah. I got to say, I love the NRA tagline about how a good guy with a gun will stop a bad guy with a gun. Well, all those military people there, the security, the police, yeah, they may have eventually stopped the bad guy with the gun after he'd killed 12 people and wounded 18 others, but there was no one that stopped that bad guy in there when it happened, even with a gun. Why is that? And that just totally blows
me. Well, that's because that one is a Kenyan Muslim socialist who has taken all the Navy and Marine Corps' guns away from them and won't let them protect freedom.
Yeah, sure. I heard an interview with one of the people there. He said, you could get a gun in here anytime. They never checked for guns. So, you know, I'm sure some good guy with a gun was in there. But,
well, the thing is, this guy was a contractor there who had apparently lost his job or something. He was described in news reports as a military contractor, which doesn't that mean like, you know, Z or, you know, one of those mercenaries types? He's a military contractor. He was a first, I can't remember what it was. First class, maybe worked on airplanes or something. Or
from what I'm hearing, I heard today possibly he was a lieutenant, but I don't know how true that is. But what I just heard when I flipped over to WTOP on the internet was that he was a former Navy man, and he was a civilian now working as a contractor. So that might be where the term military contractor comes from. He was former military working as a contractor. And that's what a lot of military does. I've got
34 years old, former Navy, military contractor. Go figure.
Yeah, I'd.
But by the time the right wing's done with him, he'll be an Al Qaeda operative. You can rest assured.
Exactly, yeah. And I don't know, have you heard anything they're talking about? They're looking for a person of interest that was a black guy?
No, the black guy's the guy who is dead.
Ah, because I...
They may be looking for somebody else, but that's been a subject of conflict all day long. They were looking for a white guy in khakis, but they found him and said he's not part of the problem.
Because what I just heard was, they got the dead guy, but they're also looking for a black guy that's a person of interest. They saw him on surveillance tape. So maybe that's the black guy with balding hair the woman was talking about. Who knows? I mean, that's the thing that drove me nuts today, too.
Well, get this, though. He was an enlisted petty officer working on electrical systems. He was discharged from the Navy following a pattern of misconduct, according to a U.S. defense official. His files are under review by the military. He was contracting in the IT area, information technology, but past that, we don't know. That according to, some cat named Mavis.
That's even interesting just in itself, Bob, because you got to figure if he was kicked out of the Navy, he got nothing more than a general discharge. So why would a contractor hire him with a general discharge? I mean, you know, you go through a person's background when you hire him. I mean, that's a red flag right there if he's got out with a general discharge.
But, yeah, and look at this. Look at how the for-profit media spins this. Now, this is way down into the CNN story. Outside Fort Worth, Texas, friend Michael Ritrovato said Alexis had recently been frustrated with the civilian contractor about a payment issue. but Ritrovato said his friend never showed signs of aggressiveness or violence, though he played a lot of shooting video games online. So, of course, we're going to work that NRA meme in there right quick about bad guys with guns and video games.
Yeah. Well,
you know, guns don't kill people, video games do.
Sure, yeah. You know, I had got no respect left for the NRA whatsoever because they, you know, when we say gun sense, I'm not talking about taking away your guns. I'm talking about background checks so people like this guy don't get a gun. And, you know, if before we got that law passed here in Colorado that the two senators got recalled for, I could go into a store and buy a gun. Blind.
I was contemplating letting that happen too, right?
Yeah. You know, I think they approved it. So, you know, if I really want a gun, just drive to Iowa or fly to Iowa and get a gun. I mean, it's just...
Because everybody needs one.
Sure. I mean, you know, fairly close range. I can shoot somebody too. It may not be the right person, but, you know...
Duncan just told me apparently the shooter worked for a subcontractor for Hewlett-Packard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I guarantee you before it's over, the fact of the background check is going to come up. And why this guy was even hired in the first place. Because if they gave him a regular good conduct discharge, but they're saying they kicked him out for bad behavior, that's not right. And then if he did get less than an honorable discharge, why was he even hired by this company? Especially with information technology being part of that deal that he had there. So, it's just, you know, and the media's got a report on this. Earlier today, they were reporting some of the guy's name as a possible shooter. They had to walk that back. And I'm thinking, just don't report it until you're positive about it. You know, it's just, there was a lot of bad information given out in the first couple hours of this story that, you know, and it goes back to that disaster junkie thing. You know, people are going to sit there and listen, and they want to hear that stuff. So
I was all excited to do the trip report this evening, and as this whole thing unfolded, I was just, because I'm selfish this way, and this would come off as asshole-ish, I guess. Damn, we're going to talk about gun. But why talk about gun violence in the United States anymore? It's a pointless conversation. I saw a tweet earlier today or something on Facebook referring to NRA as standing for Nuts Ruining America. And it's the truth. But the nuts have enough power to make sure that this happens again and again and again. And I don't care if it's me or any other progressive broadcaster, all of us together talking, it makes no difference. And that's a very dark and nihilistic place for me to be, Kevin, but it makes no difference.
Yep.
We are nationally, no matter how much hand-wringing we do, we are nationally okay with this.
Yep.
And as Kate notes, you know, it plays into our disaster violence junkie fixation.
Yep.
And I hate that.
Yep. Well, I got to say, I enjoyed your trip report. I didn't mind at all that you didn't talk about the gun thing until now because I wanted to hear about the trip. So, you know, I'm glad you did that. I did find it funny about the Baylor talking about the natural history, you know, and talking about things thousands of years
old. Oh, Kevin, knowing where I was going in, I tiptoed into that Natural History Museum looking for references to Adam. I mean, and again, that was bias on my part, and I apologize to it because it's very, I apologize for it, and I apologize to the people at the Mayborn Museum because they're obviously making credible efforts at doing real science.
Yep.
Or museum science. But, I mean, there were a couple of in the curiosity area, before you got into the parts about, you know, geology and stuff, there were some things. For instance, while there was a precious little data regarding most of the stuff, they had the skull of a humpback whale in there, okay? And you go to a natural history museum to experience these kinds of things. But they had the provenience and the provenance for the humpback whale skull. Mm-hmm. And they and the little card explained how it was discovered by obtained by a Baptist missionary in Brazil in 1905, and the Baptist missionary immediately made arrangements to have the whale skull shipped to Waco for the museum. Must have been a Baylor grad. I don't know. But I began to, that cast my understanding of that whale skull in a whole different light, because I immediately envisioned the 1905 Baptist missionary, and bear in mind the whale skull is not 15 feet from Charles Darwin's autograph, I should note. But I had this vision of the 1905 Baptist missionary with his yardstick or his tape measure or maybe some big ass calipers out, measuring the oral cavity of the skull of the whale to see if Jonah would fit.
Yep, right.
I mean, am I how far off base am I?
I doubt.
I mean, can you see that happening?
Oh yeah.
I mean, it would be another, 17 years before the Scopes monkey trial would take place in, what was it, Dayton, Tennessee?
Yep. And I found that interesting, too. They didn't have any commentary about from what you said, they didn't have any commentary about the trial or anything, or the supposed deathbed conversion, or, I find that interesting, being in Baptist school. So, you know, but, did they mention, give the weight and length of the skull and things like that?
Oh, yeah, it was there. I think I even took a photograph of it.
Do you remember roughly what the weight and height and all that was?
If you consider that if Jonah was real, it was probably something like 2,500 years ago and people were shorter. Yeah, I'm thinking that whale could have swallowed Jonah. I don't think Jonah would have been in much good shape when he got vomited back up, but, you know.
Well, I'm talking about the actual skull. What do you think the weight and height of it was?
Oh, they gave the height and weight. Wait a minute. Let me look here. I may have it.
Obviously I can't see, but it just interests me to what an actual skull would be. Because in Florida, we used to collect dinosaur bones. We donated a couple of them to museums down in the South, and God, I was surprised at how big those things were. Just a leg bone type of thing.
Let's see. They just say they may grow up to 48 feet long and weigh 65 tons. They can swim 17 miles an hour and submerge for up to 20 minutes. Highly acrobatic, lifting their huge bodies completely out of the water, yada, yada, yada. Let's see. The whale was found by Baptist missionary Zachary C. Taylor in Bahia, Brazil. In 1905, Mr. Taylor purchased the specimen and had it transported by ship and flatbed rail car to Waco, Texas, where it was placed on display in the Baylor University Museum by museum curator John K. Strecker.
Mm.
So that's, pretty much it.
Interesting. Hey, I got one thing to ask of the Horn family before I go, Bob.
Okay.
Does anybody know, I'm dealing with some chronic pain stuff, but nobody can figure out what it is. If anybody has any tips about what I can do for chronic pain that not necessarily involves prescription medicines, pass them along to me, please. I'm to the point that, I've been in bed most of the day, honestly, because that's the only comfortable position there is. It hurts to move.
Damn.
And a lot of it has to do with this humidity. Bob, it's been 2 days, and I don't think the humidity has got below 65% here. Our average humidity is like 20% on a regular day. I bet we haven't seen that in a week, and it's just driving me crazy.
Wow.
Right now, the last weather report I checked, it was overcast, cloudy, and 75% humidity. And, you know, it just, I don't know. It may be fibromyalgia. I just am at a loss. So, anything anybody's got that's natural, my mother told me someone had told her take cod liver oil. 1 teaspoon a day, that would work, but while I'm about willing to try everything, I'm not sure about the
you'll take a pass on any recommendations for a daily dosing of castor oil as well, I imagine.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. Especially the castor oil. The cod liver oil I may consider, but seriously, I got to find some solution to this because it's getting worse instead of better, and I'm hoping that the forecast is right and we're going to dry out in the next week. But so far, nothing but overcast, cloudy skies. So, anyway, with that, I'll leave you all, and I wish the Warren family the best. And for those that can donate, please do. And with that, I'll go back to living in Colorado.
All right. Thank you, Kevin. I hope you get to feeling better.
Yep. Thank you.
Take care now. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Kevin calling from Colorado Springs. Going right back to the phones in a second. A couple of emails rolling in. Let's see. What I said before the break about, you know, having to be out of here periodically. Jan and Jerry wrote in from Vegas. Jerry and I are not offended or put off if you go to fight your fight, which is why you're doing what you're doing, to save your home from the bastards trying to poison you. Our contribution will be there on Wednesday. Thanks, Bob, for all you do for all of us. Well, thanks for all that you do to keep this conversation going. Kate, with a note. Come on, folks, it's time to keep the money coming in. We need to show some interest. Bob, thanks for the travel report. I was saddened by your view of West. It sounded like New Orleans, but no fences down there to keep folks away from the toxicity. Vast, empty lots, vacant buildings, thousand-yard stares on faces of the locals who had no idea where to go next. Thanks for not flogging the recent disasters and violence. We have become violence junkies. The reason you won't find Texas slander and snarky comments funny anymore is because the natives have become human to you, showed you hospitality and positive regard. That's why our kids are trained to dehumanize the enemy and kill with patriotic abandon. They don't know any of the locals personally. Welcome home. And thanks, Kate, for practicing what you preach. I'm happy to announce we have met Betsy's Payday Challenge, and fundraising for the evening is now at $245. If we could take a bigger chunk out of that, it would be great, because that's a wonderful, wonderful start. And thanks to Betsy for the challenge to get it all to get things rolling, and thanks to Jay and Sal and Rob and Kate and Thomas. Thomas shook out the couch cushions, and that is much appreciated. A note from Dr. John regarding my remarks about the frustration I feel when I hear everybody talking about how they're going to pray for the victims. All caps, subject line, thank you. Dr. John writes, if praying makes you feel better, whatever gets you through the night. But don't mistake that for effective action. Prayer won't stop the next shooting. It's going to take a total realignment of our priorities to remove both firearms as an option to solve problems and the problems themselves. We have to deal with poverty, racism, class, and the way we define community to have a chance for change. It's a huge job. But there would be so many benefits. You know, Dr. John has a way of saying in just a very few words what takes me about 30 minutes. And every word of that is absolute 200-proof truth. This is not an insoluble problem. I don't think, and in the larger scheme of things, I don't think the United States has a single problem that is, in fact, insoluble. We can solve just about anything we set our minds to. After all, this is America, right? Don't answer. Yeah, this is America. But the effort would be worth it. What if, for instance, we responded to a mass shooting the way Australia did some years back and just made sure that such things were damn near impossible to allow to happen ever again? I saw a bit by John Cleese the other day, a very, very funny man, who, remarking upon world threat levels, said, "The sky," and this was in relation to Syria, "the English are feeling the pinch in relation to recent events in Syria and therefore have raised their security level from miffed to peeved. Soon, those security levels may be raised yet again to irritated or even a bit cross. The English have not been a bit cross since the Blitz in 1940, when tea supplies nearly ran out. Terrorists have been recategorized from tiresome to a bloody nuisance. The last time the British issued a bloody nuisance warning level was 1588, when threatened by the Spanish Armada. The Scots have raised their threat level from pissed off to let's go get the bastards. They don't have any other levels. This is the reason they've been used on the front line of the British Army for the last 300 years. And he goes on at length about a number of other countries until he comes to Australia, meanwhile, has raised its security level from no worries to she'll be right, mate. Two more escalation levels remain, namely, crikey, I think we'll need to cancel the Barbie this weekend, and the Barbie is canceled. So far, no situation in world history has ever warranted the use of the last final escalation level." Humorous, yes. But I'd kind of like to live in a culture that was actually shocked, as Robert in Australia pointed out to us a couple of weeks ago, was actually shocked and had national discussions when a cop wound up shooting a citizen. Of course, we've got a case of that in the stacks for this evening in North Carolina, the guy who was in a car wreck and a white lady upon whose door he knocked for help after the terrible, terrible car wreck, former football player for Florida A&M University, was so terrified of the black man at her door that she called 911 and the cops showed up and blew the guy away. And even the cops are saying that that was not right to do. Damn, you know. So, in the hopes that we can keep the PayPal button clicking, or the envelopes finding their way to Beckley, just as a reminder, let's go back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Jeremy, what's happening?
I was taken back by your little, Jesus moment, for better lack of a better term, about the thing that happened in Texas with the fertilizer plant and how that happens in West Virginia and other coal mining states, and they don't say anything about it when it's polluting everyone around them. But because there's a toxic explosion there, they've shut down schools and parts of towns where you can't get into anymore.
Well, from the looks of things, the high school is completely shut down, and it doesn't even appear to have been significantly damaged by the blast.
It's probably because of what's left of the fertilizer in the air and the soil from the mass explosion.
Yeah.
And they know it's toxic there, but in West Virginia, evidently they don't care it's toxic or care to turn a blind eye because their pockets are nicely lined to say it isn't. So that's kind of an odd thing. I mean, coming from all states for you to say it happened there in Texas and they saw that, that seems even more ironic. And I guess in some ways that should give us all reason to pause on some of those Texas jokes and the way we think of Texas all the time.
And yet, at the site of the fertilizer plant itself, they had a rent-a-cop security guard patrolling the grounds, and the guy wasn't even wearing a respirator. And the first thing that I didn't. Maybe this is one of those things that gets me barbecued a little hotter in hell. But I didn't say, "Hey, buddy, ask him for a mask."
You know, it's funny because I saw something. It kind of compares to that. I just saw a social media post which it shows impoverished workers, fast food workers of all people, who are asking for a decent wage. You know, maybe even $10-$15, and it compares them to what a soldier gets paid. Well, the soldier has a choice. No one forces you to go to the military and fight wars unless you get drafted. So the comparison was that the people who are working in fast food don't deserve the $15. The soldiers do. The fast food workers take their $8 and be happy with it.
Jesus, is that where we are now?
And I support the military. I'm a military person, but to an extent where I see the wrong in that statement in terms of, like, impoverished people who have working to scrape by.
So what are we supposed to do? Just shut down all the McDonald's and have them all join the military? Or maybe we should just absorb the fast food corporations into the military? I mean, this way lies fascism, right?
Right, exactly. And that's kind of what I was getting at myself there, is that I understand, but there's a point when you can't put everything in the military and say that everything is the military. That being said, in Vermont, we are going through some turmoil time with we have the largest air defense from here to Pensacola, based right here in my hometown, which are F-16s. There's 24 of them, maybe more. They want to upgrade them with the F-35s. A lot of people don't want them because they...
Oh, the boondoggle right fighter?
Yeah, the F-35, yes.
The joint... I got that wrong. That's the joint boondoggle fighter.
Yes, it had a lot of problems. But the Raptors also had a share of problems. It was poisoning its pilots a few months back, and they had to ground them all for 30 days to figure out it was doing it. But yes, they want to replace them with the F-35s. It will bring a lot of jobs here in technology here, so a lot of people don't want them. I'm torn on the issue because I want the best for our soldiers. I really do. If they're going to be put in harm's way, I want them the best.
Well, but that's a total BS comparison from jump. I mean, it just is. So what they're saying is these people put their lives on the line, potentially with bullets flying around them, and so the idea that they're making that kind of money and a McDonald's worker, no, that's comparing what? Apples and xylophones.
Exactly, yes. They choose to do that. These other people don't necessarily choose to do it. And I commend them for their choice. They want to go fight wars and get shot at, more power to them. I want nothing to do with it or anyone around me to be part of it. So I found that quite offensive in its own little way. I mean, and I think a lot of most open-minded people probably would.
Yeah.
Now to go back into a little more violence porn here for a second. I'm sure everybody's heard about the story from Friday about the California cop who killed the young 24-year-old African-American man.
Yep.
Who was looking for help.
Yes.
That...
There seems to be a spate of these. I saw another one from earlier last week out of Houston, Texas, about the cop who chased down a speeding teenager, followed into his home, beat up the teenager, then beat up the father, and dragged the mother around by her hair. We have...
Really,
I mean, let's finally just understand that we when we talk about so-called law enforcement in this country now, we are talking about a military state. The cops are militarized, and they are taught to think of common criminals as on an and by common I don't even mean criminals. I mean just simple lawbreakers as being on the same par with Al freaking Qaeda.
Now, I didn't personally see, but do you happen to know if the lady who originally called the police, if she was white?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're saying California. I thought this was Charlotte Mecklenburg, North Carolina.
I thought it was California. Whenever one of the guy knocked on the lady's door, she saw African-American.
Called 911. Yeah.
Yes.
And yes, there were like three cops on the scene, and one of the three cops unholstered his weapon and put 10 rounds through the guy, as Sandra pointed out to me a couple of minutes ago via Twitter.
Right, when he was basically, because she wasn't helping, he ran to them for help, just shot him dead summary right there because he was running at them.
Yeah.
Because he was a strange black guy on the white woman's porch knocking on the door. But we're all equal, right?
Right.
That's what people will tell you.
Well, and, you know, maybe the cops would say, hey, we'd shoot a white guy, too. This is a country that has not come to terms with its own militarization, Jeremy, and I think that's where this stems from. Because in a country that is militarized by its police, there are things you don't do. Even if you're in the right, don't run toward the cops.
Right.
And I'm not victim blaming here in the least. This is how obscene it has become. I remember when we were trying to get signatories to the AIC Act in the last Congress, the 112th, we saw Keith Ellison, a brilliant progressive member of the House of Representatives and co-chair of the Progressive Caucus in the House. Ferg and I were outside. They were coming out of their session, and that's a great way to have a one-on-one with a congressman is walk up and talk with them as they walk along. And I see Keith Ellison, and Ferg takes off running. And I'm like, stop! I wasn't like stop. I said, stop! Never run around here. You'll get stitched in half by the guys with the machine guns.
Yeah, exactly. Especially
and I mean, he pulled up in a hurry. And we calmly walked over and talked to Congressman Ellison, and he signed the bill the next day. That's kind of neither here nor there. This is not the same country anymore. This is a country that is eaten alive by its paranoia and its fear.
Right, in the name of safety over terrorism. We don't need to go to 9/11. You know, we all know there's many ideas to what happened there, and at the very least, we all know that Bush stood by when it happened. But, yeah, we're so terrorized with terror. Like I said about that, unfortunately, the shooting today, how it was giving all the Alex Jones types the right to say this is a conspiracy, he's a patsy.
Man, he was out there in a hurry, wasn't he?
He was out there today saying he was a patsy.
We're going to have to come up with a new scientific term for the period, for the incremental period of time that it takes Alex Jones to declare something a false flag operation.
Well, it wasn't even that. He said it was a patsy to discredit him of all people, Alex Jones.
I mean, here's this dumbass's tweet from earlier today.
Who will the Navy Yard shooting be blamed on? Terrorist? Tea partier? Leftist? Lone nut?
And then when he finally got behind his microphone of libertarian glory, he said,
"When you have multiple shooters like this, it has patsy written all over it. Undoubtedly, a false flag."
No, he didn't. Okay, that was Boston Marathon. Yeah. Jesus.
It has patsy written all over it.
Like I said, it's only a matter of time before someone starts. Well, they're already yelling, "He's a terrorist."
So I think the term is the unit of measurement is the Alex, and it's the period of time between a horrendous act of gun violence in the United States and the moment when Alex Jones first declares, in a fit of raving, frothing paranoia, that it's a government operation to take away his right to protect freedom.
Right.
The Alex.
He's one hell of a nut. I'll give him that. He really is. He's good for entertainment, but the fact is people take him dead serious and stop reading on every one of his words. So that's the scary part.
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, I guess I don't have a whole lot more to say. Just general disgust tonight, basically.
Well, I know, and I mean, there's stuff out there, and Jeremy, I mean, you know, don't be rough on yourself, because after a few of these things, you run out, and I'm not saying this selfishly, you run out of things to say about them. Because once you realize that this country, not by its words, but by its actions, not by its prayers, but by its realities, is okay with this happening, then really, what the F else is there to say?
Actually, you know, I just remember something. Remember, you, was it last year you went to Germany and to the forest, Black Forest, all that fun stuff?
Yeah. Didn't make it to the Black Forest, but yeah.
Do they have stricter gun laws than we have here? In Germany?
Yeah, I think you could probably say that, but they still have gun ownership.
Well, I listened to a comedy duo, and they went to Canada last month for the comedy festival, we'll say. And up there, they're in Montreal. Most people don't have weapons. You can't own weapons in Canada. And they asked people, do you feel safe about crime? Nobody can come up with any serious crimes, not even stabbings in Montreal. And they said, do you feel safe walking the street at night? This is on Catholic Street, which, if you're not familiar with the area, that's the strip, literally the strip, to put it nicely. And people all there were just kind of flabbergasted, them asking all these questions about fear and horrible stuff like we are petrified here of. Nobody was afraid to walk the streets at like 2 a.m. in the morning in Montreal. In a major metropolitan situation.
Now, understand, Canada has lots of guns. Lots of people own right. guns in Canada. They probably got a proportionally a similar number of guns in Canada as to what we have here.
But they don't seem to have half the shootings we have here, even close to it. They don't even come close.
Right.
I mean, just like, well, we know they can't have guns in Britain, though. And they have, like 5 billy clubbings a year?
Yeah.
But only you're going to make.
No, for a minute there, I was afraid, Jeremy. For a minute there, I thought you were going to tell me that you heard a German comedian, and I was going to say, "Now stop, wait a minute."
No. I was just trying to compare some of these other countries, and you don't hear these horror stories. And I mean, they're not involved so tightly wrapped up in this ongoing, perpetual, never-ending war on terror, which has got white America in a froth every time you see someone of darker skin. It's just frustrating.
Well, in fact, Darlene just wrote in and said, but I heard on Democracy Now this morning that the man was running away from the cops and they shot him. What am I missing here? Did the story change? Well,
the story is he turned from the porch where the cops showed up, ran towards one of the cops, and this one officer opened up on him.
Or that's the report that he gave, that he was advancing rapidly upon the cop, and the cop just blasted him.
Well, the commissioner basically came out the night it happened and said that he made a rapid movement towards one of our officers and shot him in fear for his own life. But that same officer today turned himself in for voluntary manslaughter.
And the thing is, they tried to tase him and missed.
Yeah, but still, I mean, he had a car. He was asking for help, trying to probably say something about this accident, and they just take it. He was well liked in his community. He wasn't a bad guy. He was well spoken of. He didn't have any criminal record. He wasn't swinging drugs. Wasn't doing drugs. Wasn't high. Wasn't drunk.
No, was just in a terrible, terrible car accident. Apparently,
right. He was in a terrible car accident. Ran to the wrong house with a crotchety old lady who saw a young black male. Got terrified. Called the police. Removed this strange black man from my property. And they sure removed him, didn't they?
Again, the culture is changing, and the citizenry are not keeping up with the changes, Jeremy.
But it's not to the point where we're shocked anymore. We're almost kind of like neutral to the feeling of it because it happens so often. It's just, you come to expect it now. I mean, Was this naval shooting any surprise? Not really. It's only been a couple weeks since the last major type thing has happened here, shooting another of that, or accidental killing of a child because of his father's gun left unaccounted. Whatever. This happens.
In fact, I just got a note a little bit ago from Texas Betsy pointing out there's a woman with a Twitter account in Texas by the name of Peggy Allen, and her Twitter page, her Twitter bio or whatever, says, "My name is Peggy. We have a Trayvon situation here in Dallas, Texas. My stepson was unarmed and shot 7 times, once in the back by a Dallas policeman. 25-year-old Clinton Allen. Yeah, 7 times shot by a Dallas police officer, once in the back."
Yeah, we've had similar things happen in Vermont and with our own state police, where police claim they fired X amount of shots, and 2 of the shots were dead center in the back.
And the story goes on to note that the district attorney there is Craig Watkins. He's been in office since 2006. And in that period of time, over 20 unarmed men have been murdered by policemen, of which 96% of the victims are black, 98% of the cops doing the killings are white, and the DA has never indicted even one.
Indicative of the times. The civil rights movement has come and gone, and in some ways very little has changed. A lot has, but in some ways very little has, and we still have a long, long ways to go.
Remember, this is a post-racial culture.
So they say.
Right. Jeremy, have yourself a good evening.
You too.
Take care. Bye now. Jeremy, our buddy, calling from Vermont. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
I guess you'll say that when I'm done, but how are you?
How you doing, Bill?
Hanging in. I'm glad that the Texas trip sounded good. It sounded like it was worthwhile.
It was. It was very worthwhile, and I met some amazingly courageous people.
Well, they have to be, you know, that's... the situations are pretty bad all over this place when it comes to pollution. You're getting it dumped on your head, you know. But other people are getting it through their water pipes, and you name it, they'll find a way to... there are places in Lake County along the Grand River that... were being used for different stuff in World War One and Two that are kind of scary. And I remember this time of the year, the steelhead trout or in the old days, the coho salmon used to stack up at the river mouths. And, you know, I'd work my way back upriver as time went on, you know, waiting. And I looked around me sometime and said, "Bill, do you want to eat anything you catch in here?" "No." you catch a nice trout, you know, and you'd put it back. You didn't quite know whether you wanted to eat it or not. Although they were good if you smoked them, I guess, you know.
Well, you know, that smoked mercury has a really nice flavor to it.
I guess that's why this... Well, you eat one of those and you look in the mirror and you see this red thing going up from your neck to the top of your head, you know. The old Elmer Fudd anger meter, if you remember that.
I do.
Yeah, yeah. It's when you're talking today about the shooting today, I couldn't believe that one. I said, "My God," because the guy's all disconcerted from a damn hell of a car accident.
But right, head injury, shock, trauma. Hello.
Yeah, exactly.
But this shows the depth of the problem that we have, Bill. Because think back to the story from what, a month, 2 months ago. A cop in Florida pulls over a man of color who doesn't respond well, drags him to the drunk tank, dumps him on the floor, and the whole damn time he's having a stroke.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like...
And he dies there.
What kind of education are these guys getting?
Well, that reminds me of something. We had a story years ago now, I guess, about a man who was suing the police department, I think it was in New York. And what he found out, he took the cop test, okay, the test that you have to take to be a cop. And he scored about as high on the cop test as you can score. And they refused to hire him on that basis. Because it turns out that you don't get to be a cop if your IQ is above a certain level.
Well, let's see, I can see there what they think, yeah.
And so they're not exactly going for Sherlock Holmes out there.
There's a certain amount of prejudice that I have found. Because I believe me, Bob, when it comes to higher mathematics, you know, I have to get out the adding machine, you know, both hands, you know.
Right.
And to go to work. But other things, reading and comprehension, I finished in like the upper 10% of the people that were tested in this one test. So that was good for me. You know, that's the old American way of learning. You read. And you read enough, and you studied, and you sorted out stuff, and you came to some conclusion or the other that hopefully was not completely wrong. You know, in my case, I was hoping it's not completely wrong. But what's going on? I know one guy who wanted to be a cop so bad, just like Zim, you know. And he kept flunking, and the woman that was my second wife had a master's in psych. And her feeling was that when this guy got to the psychological part of the police test, they floated him out the door. And from knowing him, he was one that would shoot. I mean, you know, Bob, there was a time when I carried a gun because of my late night work and God knows where.
Right.
And a bunch of people who were potentially really drunk and wanted to fight with the first idiot that came across their path. And I objected to that. That's, you grew up in a inner city neighborhood as a kid. The fighting was a way of life. This fighting, constant, all of that. So anyway, I had an attitude, but damned if I, you know, I never used it. This guy I know, he was down in a park area, and a guy was running his dog, and the other guy took exception to the guy running his dog. Now, believe me. I owned many dogs, but man, I did not believe in running a dog without a leash. Because it's dangerous for the dog. Bob, a dog sees another dog across the street. And for some reason, the dogs understand and not. I mean, I've been accused of being a son of a dog many times. But.
Of a particular gender?
Well, kind of, yeah. But to make a long story short, a dog will take off chasing something. And they don't see that truck coming. So I always believed in leashing mine when I was walking them in traffic areas. But still, this other guy, I know, he pulls out a .357 and kills the dog. And I thought, what the hell did you do that for? Dog attack you? No. But I told the guy to put a leash on him, and the guy wouldn't do it, and blah, blah, blah. Go over and smack the owner upside the chops, maybe. But the damn dog didn't do anything. And that's the one thing I worked. University Circle bars were police hangouts for one of the toughest districts in the city. And the guys that I really got along with well and understood pretty well were the guys who had taken the government-sponsored tour of Southeast Asia. Because a lot of those guys had it up to the top of their heads. They didn't have to prove a damn thing anymore, Bob. They had been through stuff that you and I wouldn't have wanted to be through.
No, absolutely.
But, and they didn't carry an attitude on the outside of their bodies. I wouldn't mess with them, but this stuff today, where the guys are shooting first, it was ridiculous. Are you familiar with the Canadian story?
I guess not.
A guy in Toronto grabbed one of the streetcars and ordered everybody off. Now, he's on the damn car by himself. Was just a knife. They shot him to death. And I guess they're going to prosecute the guy. The cop did. And I mean, they really opened up. They had tape going. And you heard enough gunshots, you know, it sounded like an old Western movie, you know, in the background. I said, this is nuts. I remember going to Canada, which I like to do in the early days of fishing. I like Canada because you'd. Niagara Falls, there was a. An ethnic restaurant of Hungarian extraction where the woman had the great food the proper kosh and the veal.
Yeah.
And the Viennese veal, you know. What the hell do they call that anyway, the veal? That kills me. Sometimes I forget stuff. The style of cooking, wasn't cordon bleu, it wasn't...
Schnitzel?
Schnitzel, sure. Vienna veal.
Wiener schnitzel.
Yeah. And they had this, they bring out a thing called a Black Forest platter. A huge platter with two sausages, two stuffed cabbage, two of everything. I went up there with my first wife.
Oh, stuffed cabbage. Oh.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That was my dad's mother.
I think there's an Eastern European name. I think something like Haluki.
Oh, Gonki or something like that. I've heard it called. Yeah, stuffed cabbage. Because Cleveland's loaded. Cleveland used to be loaded with good Eastern European restaurants at one point in time. When there's still a few around. But to make a long story short, this Canadian situation, as I say, the guy, the first time I went there, the first time I went up fishing, I'm coming across the border, towing a 14-footer and boat in those days. And the guy says to me, the border crossing guy, the Canadian, says, you've got a gun. And the way he put it sounded like he was not asking me a question. He's saying I should have. And I said, no. I said, do all of a sudden you need them up here? And he said, no, but, you know, he thought I was being smart. But, yeah, this situation in Toronto, they ended up killing a guy. And the guy was obviously a mental case, you know. I mean, he was obviously a person who was having maybe deep depression, bipolar, who the hell knows, hallucinations, you know. But he didn't harm anybody. He asked everybody to leave the trolley, the streetcar, and then they killed him. And when that happens up there, those guys were not notorious 20, 30 years ago for that kind of stuff. So you're hitting it on the nose with this kind of behavior. It's funny you mentioned Texas. And I remember their first Civil War history books, they referred to them as Texicans.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was... I imagine if you called somebody, some of those guys down there a Texican, they'd smack you. You know, some of these...
I don't know. I remember hearing John Wayne use that phrase in the movie version of The Alamo.
But I saw it in books, you know. Civil War stuff, because they were... they made a big reputation in the Southern Army, the Texans. Hood.
Well, John Bell Hood, of course, Fort Hood in Texas is named after him, and I guess a big chunk of Fort Hood sits in Bell County, Texas.
Okay. Because Hood was quite the division commander and brigade commander, but when he was assigned to command the Army of Tennessee after Johnston faded, you know, he kept retreating towards Atlanta. And
The folks in Atlanta would have really liked it if he hadn't done that.
Yeah. Well, Joe Johnston and Jefferson Davis did not get along well at all. It's funny what you learn about human natures and people in history books, because all they are names and pictures until somebody gives you a well-researched history of them and you find out this and that those two guys didn't like each other. General Hood, when he was given command of the Army of Tennessee, he was short an arm, a leg. He was physically a mess. Brave man, and a good division and corps commander. But the first thing he did was go full tilt boogie after Sherman and those guys outside Atlanta, and militarily it was a huge mistake. You know.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how well I would do down south, because I have this terrible attitude. Because, Bob, when you look at the war between the states, can you tell me one major battle out west of the mountains? You know, what they call the Western Theater, that the Southerners ever won something?
They came close at Shiloh, but that was, you know, close didn't count.
No.
And I guess there were a few skirmishes maybe in Missouri and Arkansas, but nothing of any real consequence, no.
All all the majors were those, because the I don't know, it was not the bravery of men on both sides in that war astounds me, and of course it showed up pretty well between 1941 and 45, did it not? The same kind of toughness that those fellows exhibited. But what a way to do, you know, my God, I kept, you know, the more you read when I was starting to learn about it, I said, couldn't they have talked this thing out better? 600,000 dead out of 30 million? I don't think they teach enough of that kind of statistic to the American kids that, you know, what it did to this country. But we have this problem. You know, there was a whole lot of Germans settled in Texas, were there not?
Oh, absolutely. There's all kinds of little German communities.
Yeah,
and Czech community. There's a Norwegian community.
Yeah. The guy that commanded the Marines in Korea, I just did a book, Opie Smith, his mother was Germanic, and they talked about that, and that's how I learned about the, you know, the settlements down there, because his mother was. And thank God for that guy, as if you were a Marine in Korea in 1950, and MacArthur's chief of staff, who had been given command of that side of the Korean Peninsula, that guy was a, according to writers other than me, I mean, I'm talking about professional writers, and in fact, Halberstam, I'm working a book by him right now. And you keep learning. People say, why do you keep hashing the same stuff? I said, the more opinions you get, and this is what teaches you how to take a well-rounded look at everything that's going on around here. But the bottom line that I can't understand is my one buddy who teaches history in Lake County, he says, they don't want you teaching the Depression era at all anymore. You know, they don't want the kids to know what it was like. But I'm of an age where, and like you probably, growing up, you heard a lot of stuff from the family about the toughness of,
oh, yeah,
of the Great Depression. And I mean, I see it now in the social programs we've got going on in this country that I fell into with the eye problems in my old age. They're half-assed. They have all these companies that have health aides, and they're all little companies that are, you know, that should be actually run by the counties and the states, not by a guy. Some guy with a little bit of money sets up a company and starts hiring people. And all he's interested in, and you know what they're interested in as far as employers, how cheap can
right.
they hire a worker? And I don't know about you, but one thing I seem to learn quickly in this country, if you're lucky, you get what you pay for. You know,
right.
Anything, car mechanic, a painter, whatever you're hiring. Sometimes if you're lucky and the guy's charging you, he's earning his money because he's competent and honest. We see it in the news medium today. The woman that couldn't pronounce Appomattox.
Appomattox?
Yeah, Appomattox.
Or the parachuting millionaire for-profit media journalist who pronounced it Calliope.
Yeah, Calliope, that musical instrument they used to use with circuses and carnivals. Yeah, Calliope. And, of course, the worst was that sick announcement of the names of the Korean airliner officers. And these people, and that was Fox News, was it not?
Oh, that was the Fox affiliate in San Francisco, yeah.
How stupid are these people? Well, anyway, I'll let somebody, before I show how stupid I can be, I'll clear the line at somebody else, but... yeah, you're fighting a hard cause down there, and I try to tell people about it. And I have some friends, one friend in particular, who sold a lot of her property to the frackers. But her reasoning was that God only knows where those people go when they go in at point A, and God knows where they are underground, because nobody who can see them.
Right.
You tilt that drill, or you tilt the angle or two on it. Wasn't there something about Hussein and Kuwait about oil drilling, where Osama might have been coming in at an angle?
Yeah, you mean horizontal drilling?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that although most people don't know about it, Bill, that was our first real introduction to yeah, because that's how fracking works.
Uh-huh.
May not necessarily be the same thing, but some of the principles are the same.
Yep, you never know which way these go. Oh, I got a nice call today. I was talking to a couple of our family members who are good, positive computer geeks, shall we say. And I'm using that in a positive, in other words, they know the damn things. I got a call from some woman with a heavy, it sounded like the lady who used to do the fortune telling with the Jamaican accent. Yeah, this call came through for somebody. They wanted to know all about my computers. I said, well, I don't have them anymore. They don't work anymore. You know, because I figured it out right away. She worked, what did she, called herself some kind of a thing, working for Microsoft. And that smells right off the bat, you know. So I don't know what, they're fishing. They're fishing, they want to get...
Sure.
They want to get personal information out of you. I wish I had a few old, out-of-date credit cards that have been unusable since 20 years ago. I'd give them a couple. Here, go have some fun with this one. See how far you get. Because I wouldn't try to use it if I were you, buddy. Yeah, so, but you know, you can almost smell it. Have you ever had any of those calls, Bob?
No, but I get a lot of... notes on Facebook from women who are deeply impressed by my profile and want me to message them off Facebook. I figure they probably need some help with a Nigerian estate or something like that.
Yeah, I got a couple of those, too, letters. Some guy was willing to leave me money for something or other. Jeez, I should be that lucky, huh? Anyway, take care. To my friend Kevin out there, hang in there, buddy. It's
yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that because we had more than one person suggest and maybe noting that, you know, Kevin lives in Colorado, that he might wish to avail himself of some medical cannabis for its rather amazing pain-relieving qualities.
Yeah. Well, I'm a person that's kind of funny. At age 70, I'm a second-generation pot smoker. My old man got popped with a pound of the stuff in 45. But my uncle worked for the guys as a technician. The guys that J. Edgar Hoover said didn't exist. You know, organized crime.
Right, yeah.
I guess it must have been disorganized because there sure as hell was a lot of it. Anyway, take care of yourself. I'm glad to have you back again.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks so much. It's awful good to hear from you.
Take care.
Bye now. Mr. Stress, Bill, calling from Cleveland. And we go onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, you're back, huh?
Well, don't sound so danged excited, Jim.
Well, you're back.
I am indeed.
Good. Glad you had a good time.
It was a good trip. It was a very informative, learning kind of trip.
Well... not everybody down there is gonna, you know, be like what you thought they would be. And
oh, I already knew there were a lot of people down there. Shucks, there's probably more progressive people in the state of Texas than there are in Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, South Carolina, and West Virginia combined.
Well, I don't mean progressive people necessarily in your definition, but there are a lot of people who are, you know, who've been painted with a bad brush about the world being 7,000 years old, stuff like that, is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, I understand, yeah.
The reason I call is beware of any calls you get from anybody who tells you that they're from Microsoft or whatever and your computer files, according to their records, are in danger of being destroyed and this, that, and the other.
So you've had these too?
Oh, yeah, I've had two. And what they are, these are coming from probably China or some other place, and they have a node in Washington State, in Hanford, Washington, because it'll come up to this 216 number, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So beware of those people because they will try to really ruin you.
By getting your data, or
oh well, the first thing they want to talk to you about is apparently they have some way of accessing what's in your system. And they have enough information to give you cause for concern, but their accent is so thick and their English is so poor. And my first response to them was, is English your second, third, or fifth language?
That bad.
That bad. And then that gets them a little upset. And I said, let me speak to your supervisor. You got one? And they don't want you to do that because that's going to make them look bad, I guess, in their chain of command. And finally, I got a hold of one guy. And I said, look, buddy, I don't know what part of the world you're calling from, but do not call this number again. If you do, I have your number on my caller ID, and I'm calling the FBI in D.C. I have a good friend who deals with just this sort of thing. You have a nice day, you asshole.
Nothing like a little punctuation, Jim.
Well, and he called me a son of a bitch.
Well, they're teaching the finer points of English in Bangalore now.
Apparently they are, yes indeed. But I mean, these people, do not let them, and the first thing they'll tell you to press your Windows key and that and the other, and just hang up. The first time they called, that's when they sort of had me going. I said, how do you know this information? And so we have access to your records. We all, I said, yeah, you and Charlie Chan, right?
Oh.
But don't ever give those people any information because they are extremely vindictive. And apparently they have enough information in your system to give you a hard time, okay?
And apparently this is a growing scam. I mean, I haven't gotten any of these calls over here.
Well, I don't know if it was, I don't know who these people were, but their accents were so thick and, their English was so bad I couldn't understand them, and that just really bothers me an awful lot to have to talk to somebody like that. But particularly when they just have enough information to make themselves reasonably credible, then that's when you need to have to get off the phone and especially get their number. And of course, and what I did, I immediately called the FBI in D.C. I have a friend who works in that department.
And of course, Marty pointing out that the number that showed up on your caller ID might even be phished in its own right. That's not unusual.
It's a node. They route these calls through Hanford, Washington. It's a 216 area code, if I'm not mistaken.
And then Fritz just noted several months ago, I got a phone call from my parents, he says, one night, who are not on the Internet, telling me about a text message that they received asking about some info from Google. And he told them immediately that it was a scam.
Oh, there are plenty of them out there, let me tell you. It's just incredible how bold they are becoming and just, absolutely... Well, and then when you hang up, sometimes they'll call back. And I just told one guy, I said, didn't you get enough the first time?
Jeez.
I said, I've got nothing to do right now but to sit here and just, make you feel bad about yourself, but I don't care to do that because that doesn't help me any, so why don't you get off my fucking phone? Just told him exactly that. And, like I say, they can be extremely aggressive and demonic as far as what they can try to do. I mean, they can really mess you up. Because I called, when I talked to the Bureau, the guy in the Bureau, he said, look, beware of those people. He said, they do have access to certain things of your files, and they can hurt you.
Without a doubt.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's why I have never replied to any of these, I'm sure, charming women who have contacted me on Facebook, who are so fascinated with my profile.
What do they say?
Oh, God. It's pigeon English and...
What did it say? Is that a pistol in your pocket? Or you
No, nothing so enjoyable as all that, Jim. Let's see if I can find one. Here. Ah, yeah, here's one now. This one came in at 2:42 today. Hello, dear. Sorry if I invaded your privacy. I was actually captivated by your profile here on Facebook, and I couldn't help writing you to compliment on that. I would love to be friends with you if you do not mind. I just got online today. I hardly come online because of some private reasons. You can contact me through my private email. I hope to hear from you. Please write me directly via email. And I get about one of those a day.
I wonder what they want.
Money, data, access.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's basically what they try to do, and they don't even know how to do it well. But thankfully, you know, their own flaws and discrepancies in communication sort of like put you on the alert for that. So that's just a bad thing. I mean, it's just really a cyber attack as far as I'm concerned. That's what it is.
Well, and you never know how many of these are. Remember the New York Times story, Jim, about the people who unit of the People's Army of the Republic of China that has this may be that. This is maybe some
that's
of this isn't the
is.
Scamming. This is an
that's
attempt
what,
to.
That's exactly what my friend in D.C. told me. He said these calls come from China.
So one never knows.
Mm-mm. And as far as today is concerned, that's just another day of horror for me. You know, I just couldn't believe that.
Well, it's got to be brutal because I'm sure you know that. I'm sure you know that turf pretty well.
Pretty well, yeah. I've been up there. I've been to the naval facility there in D.C. and I don't know, when I heard about it, I was just absolutely appalled as the story began to unfold with the increasing numbers of people who have been killed. 12?
13, counting the shooter.
Well.
And more still, you know, more still coming in as injured.
And I especially, for God knows, the ones who were killed. May God have mercy on them. And as far as that other poor guy whose legs were literally shot out from under him, they don't even know if he'll be able to walk because apparently the shooter just shot his, not only the bones of his legs, but the major arteries, veins, and everything. I mean, they don't even know if he'll be able to walk. And he's probably getting out of surgery now. So, I mean, it's just, these people today were simply getting up for another Monday morning's work, going to work.
Yeah, it's just another day at the office, right?
Exactly. And, you know, some of the people they interviewed, I thought, you know, they did pretty good. CNN did pretty well with the interviews and things of that nature because it was a very fluid situation there at first. And, I mean, when you go into a situation where a guy goes into a very secure headquarters, It really kind of flipped me out because...
One of the people explained right away that if he had the right ID, he could have had a gun in his trunk and it would have gotten right through.
Yeah, they don't x-ray your baggage and stuff like that if you have the right credentials to get through and if you're authorized to be there. That's right. I mean, first, to get in the gate, you got to have a sticker and everything. And if you don't, they'll pull your car over and, you know, find out what the hell you're doing there, inspect it or whatever. And if you have an appointment, then they'll verify that. And if it's a valid appointment, they'll send you on through because you have to be verified. And then when you get to the building itself, you have to have some type of ID mechanism. And as they pointed out, it's green, you go through. But apparently this guy, I don't know what was he like a chief petty officer or something like that?
He actually finished out a... I had it here just a minute ago.
He was a petty officer.
Well, they've reported that, but I've got his biographical data here that's been put out by... his rating was Aviation Electrician's Mate, 3rd Class, AE3.
Okay. That would put him as some type of petty officer, I believe.
Third class?
I believe so. I'm not that familiar with Navy ranks because I never had a whole lot to do with the Navy. Whenever I had meetings with the Navy, they basically came to Andrew to see me. And, you know, I think they kind of like to get out of there and stuff like that. It was just we had a better setting and a better type thing for the meetings that I conducted for, you know, at my headquarters. So,
well, when he separated, he was with Fleet Logistics Support Squadron 46, Fort Worth, Texas, separated 31 January 2011, and then he became an independent contractor working as a sub for Hewlett-Packard working for the Navy.
Oh, yeah. Well, the security clearances on people like that is severely lacking. It really is with contractors.
Well, once again, we get another example of whoever it is that's doing the vetting. I mean, if he was discharged after disciplinary problems, well, hello.
Well, you know, unfortunately, in the vetting process, particularly with contractors and things of that nature, you have a lot of people who slip through the cracks who should not slip through the cracks and should not be allowed on the facility. And that's the whole thing, that's the whole problem I have with the contracting process. I mean, once they get the contract and stuff like that, they'll turn it over to the contractor and place that responsibility upon his shoulders. You know, it's kind of like, you know, because...
Well, right, and see, what there's a common thread here, if you think about it, Jim. Consider this guy and Edward Snowden. Okay, I'm not saying that they are morally the same, but in both instances, they were vetted by some outside agency that completely screwed up in both cases.
Well, that's true too, and you know, you've got to look at the whole picture. Some of the worst people who've ever caused us problems, as far as, you know, selling secrets and stuff like that, have been people who've had top security clearance.
Well, and
you never really know. I mean, you know, you think you have a firewall in place that will protect you and, you know, assure that you are going to be having reliable people. But the best laid plans of mice and men, there it is.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, Robert from Australia just wrote in and said, with regard to the phone calls that you were talking about, if anyone gets a phone call saying that your computer is calling their computer, sending it error messages, and they need to access your computer, Robert says, I'd suggest responding as I did, to wit, my computer's calling yours, but I don't have a computer. You'll hear an instant click as they hang up. He says, I had 3 calls on the same day back in March, then nothing.
That's exactly what they say. That is exactly verbatim what they say. Thank you, Robert.
And he says, and yes, the caller had very poor English with a heavy accent.
Yeah, I mean, these people are doing all kinds of stuff. I mean, cyber warfare is just really in a stage of infancy compared to what they're going to try to do. I mean, it's just amazing what they, I don't know. It's really kind of frightening because you're not even securing your own home. If they can violate your system and say these kinds of things, it really makes me sort of, well, you know, it's a paranoid country, as you pointed out earlier.
It is that.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed the museum trip and the trip to Texas and all the good food you had to eat down there. That's great. So you're back in the saddle, huh?
I am indeed. I am indeed, Jim. Hopefully we'll be able to keep things going.
Well, that's great. Listen, next time you're in D.C., I want to hear about, if you can, I think you need to take your son to the Holocaust Museum. If you like museums, that's one you need to visit.
Well, now that he's back in school, he won't be going to D.C. for a while.
Well, then take yourself there and take a look at it. I think it'd be very worthwhile for the time you spend to go to that museum.
Yeah, in my case, I certainly have no objections to going. I just know that it's going to be a brutal experience. And I've thought about it a couple of times and just wasn't. I mean, I wasn't emotionally able.
Well,
it's something that should never be forgotten, and it's something that never always needs to be remembered. And sometimes I think people sort of let things like that slide and just don't pay attention to it a lot very more. And basically, it never hurts to give yourself a good reminder about things that have happened in the past, because those who do not pay attention to the past, unfortunately, we'll see it repeated. And I think that's the purpose of that particular structure and museum. It really is. I mean,
without a doubt. And
I mean, once you go through there, it will give you a very different perspective, I think, on a lot of things.
Well, thanks, Jim.
And I recommend it highly. I certainly do. Of all the museums. I mean, you know, I've been to all of them in D.C., including some of the other ones I've told you about with the Russian history and all that stuff. But mm-hmm. The Holocaust Museum, that was definitely one that I have never been the same since, and in a very positive way.
Indeed.
It's getting time for you to get out here, isn't it?
Hey, it is.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You take care, Jim. Have a good night.
All right, same to you.
All right, bye now.
Later.
Our buddy Jim. And so we have approached the end of the evening's program. Let's see. Kate was the last person to kick in to help keep things going here. That was 7:22 before the halfway point of the program. Oh, wait just a second. Let me double check. Yeah. And not much sense. It really does matter in how we manage to keep all of this going when you hit the PayPal button, because there aren't any ads here. Nobody's going to ask you to buy any gold. And the other, you know, we're not selling anything to anybody. Remember, when you contribute, you make it possible not just for this to continue, but you make it possible for people to listen who otherwise can't or couldn't if we were selling the podcast or selling access to the broadcast. And, of course, the thanks go out from all of us, those of us behind the mic, around the mic, who keep all of this stuff going, and from the family, from the interrelated members of the Horn family who you hear from, and many, in fact, from whom you don't. So thank you. Thank you kindly. And maybe we've done enough this evening that we can pick up the other half tomorrow night. Thanks. Michael, writing in from... Norway. Oh, the Microsoft security scam. This has happened to my mom here in Norway, too. What they do is ask you to enter the event log in Windows. The reason they do that is because it's completely normal to have things like critical or fatal error on that list. So they get the victim all worked up about this and then ask them to go to some VPN service and basically allow them full access. As soon as the VPN login has occurred, they have full access to the system and can gather any information they like from that computer in the background, invisible for the user. Quite the nasty affair. Mom didn't bite, by the way. Well, that's because Mom is smart, Michael. And obviously, she raised a sharp son. A bunch of stuff we didn't get to tonight, some of which will be saved for prayer meeting Wednesday. But a little heads up just to be thinking about, also on Wednesday there will be a vote in the House of Representatives on something that they are Orwellianly calling the Nutrition Reform and Work Opportunity Act, which it would be NRWOA, which is often referred to as the Farm Bill, and is part of the bifurcation that took place earlier, where they separated out one part from another. What it boils down to is on Wednesday, the soulless, motherless, monstrous freaks of the right wing are going to be voting on not whether or not to screw hungry people in this country, but how much to screw them. Keep an eye out. You might want to read up. And you might want to be just bold enough to maybe tell people that, tell other people you know, talk about it in the, you know, in the grocery store line and so forth, that poor folks, hungry folks, are looking at an effing in the very near future. Like Wednesday, whenever so many fundies will be going to the real prayer meeting. I'm awfully glad to be home and awfully grateful to the folks who provided such a warm welcome down in Waco. Thank you again to Dr. Allen and the Waco Friends of Peace. I learned so much and was so honored to have been invited down there, and so gratified to see people willing to take action on behalf of this tormented part of our country, Appalachia. Thank you, one and all. Titanic Tuesday on the way tomorrow. If we can keep hitting the PayPal button, maybe I can announce that we've only got to raise the usual evening's fundraising tomorrow. Be here one way or the other, or we'll try, as long as the mic is hot. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen, you first and foremost, with your time, your ideas, your comments, your tweets, your emails, your chat room participation, your calls. Thank you. Thank you for your kind contributions, as noted. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks always go out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch. CRMW.net and ACHECT.org. ACHECT.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Rick Smith is on the way, on the horn.